Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why has America forgotten about the Korean War? As we commend the achievements and recognize the sacrifices of our men and women in uniform on this Veterans Day, my guest today wants to be sure we remember the 1.8 million who served in the Korean War in the early 1950s. The conflicts were brutal, with more than 33,000 U.S. troops killed and more than 90,000 wounded. And the earliest weeks of the war were some of the most shocking, as U.S. leaders realized they had trimmed military staffing and budgets too drastically at the end of the Second World War. Writer Bill Sloan is a former investigative reporter for the Dallas Times-Herald. His new book explains how the early months of the war saw first a stunning defeat for U.S. and South Korean forces, followed by a dramatic reversal, won more by strategy than by might. It's called The Darkest Summer, Busan and Incheon in 1950, the battles that saved South Korea and the Marines from extinction. Bill, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
I was really amazed to read just how much the U.S. had reduced the size of its military by the end of the Second World War. We're talking less than 10% of what it had been at the peak.
Right, right. Well, some reduction, of course, was to be expected when the war, the big war, ended. But there was a lot of sentiment in Washington to cut very deeply into the military budget. There was the feeling that we possessed the atomic bomb and nobody was going to step on our toes with that in mind. And so the Truman administration also had a plan to unify the military services. And that bode ill for the Marine Corps, since it was the smallest service, and it also kind of overlapped into areas that other services thought were their domain.
Talk for a minute about the geographic distribution of the troops that we did have on the payroll in 1950.
Well, most of them in the, I mean, there were a lot of them in the Far East, but they were all in Japan. And they were troops that were on occupation duty, pretty leisurely, you know, low-tension type jobs, and they had not been well-trained in combat operations. There were other troops in Europe, of course, but we were stretched thin, and we didn't have any troops to spare. The troops that we used in Korea had to come from Japan. That was the closest place we had anybody available.
How was Korea divided at the 38th parallel at the end of the Second World War?
Rather haphazardly, actually. You know, the Soviet Union jumped into the war just 1 week before it ended, and they were poised to collect part of the spoils. Nobody gave very much thought to exactly what should be done with Korea. It was not a strategically important area as far as the United States was concerned. And the 38th parallel was sort of plucked out of the air as a temporary dividing line between the area of Soviet occupation and the area of U.S. occupation. And it just remained in effect. The Soviets honored that line, that boundary line, to the surprise of some, but they had their mind set on larger spoils than that at the time.
Well, and tellingly, even back then, the South had more people, more good agricultural land, and more industry than the North.
That's absolutely correct. The North is largely a wasteland, actually, and none of the major industries in Korea are located there, even today. I mean, North Korea is such a primitive, backward country, destitute country in comparison to South Korea. And they had a little more land territory under the arrangement with the 38th parallel, but it wasn't worth a lot.
What's really interesting is that the U.S. was more concerned that the South would invade the North than the other way around.
Well, yeah, there was some concern about that, especially after Syngman Rhee took over as president of South Korea, because he was a very militant individual, and he wanted to unify the Koreas under his leadership. And, of course, there were across the border incursions by both sides, But one of the most serious ones was just a few months before the North Korean invasion. And the South Korean army went in and actually occupied some villages that were, you know, several miles inside North Korea. So there was that feeling that the South Koreans couldn't be totally trusted with the latest weapons, and they didn't get the latest weapons.
So in a story that sounds somewhat familiar, when Korea was divided, the Korean people were not really asked their opinion, and Syngman Rhee was the head of this U.S.-backed provisional government.
Right, right. And it's important to remember that the Koreans had no experience in self-government. They had never run their own country, their own industry. They had always been under the domination of either the Chinese or the Russians or the Japanese. And it was like starting from square one because they just didn't know anything about how to organize a government or an economic system.
So part of the role of the U.S. in the south part of the country was to get the South Korean military ready to be self-sufficient. Can you talk about the kind of assessments that U.S. leaders gave as to how militarily ready South Korea was?
Well, they gave very misleading assessments. The general who commanded the Korean Military Advisory Group, which was a group of U.S. officers who were assigned to train the ROK soldiers, called them, you know, the best damn army outside the United States. So there was a lot of self-delusion going on with the American military at this point in time. They were not well trained. They were mostly conscripts, and they were, had been jerked up and taken away from their homes. There was no core of trained military leaders in South Korea as there was in the North, because the North Koreans had helped the Chinese, the communist Chinese, chase Chiang Kai-shek off the Asian continent, and they had a lot of good field officers.
And the South Koreans weren't, you mentioned that a lot of them were conscripts, they weren't necessarily loyal at all to Syngman Rhee's government.
No, there was a lot of disloyalty to Rhee's government, and Rhee instituted a very dictatorial regime. He quashed the free press. He had his political rivals arrested, and there's suspicion that in some cases he had them assassinated. So, yeah, there was a lot of discontent in South Korea with the Rhee regime.
So compare for a minute the kinds of weapons capability that the folks in the North had with the backing of the Soviet Union, as opposed to those in the South who had the U.S. on their side.
The Soviets supplied the North Koreans with the best military equipment that was available at the time. Their T-34 tanks, which had been the tanks that won the Battle of Stalingrad in World War II. They had the best heavy artillery, mobile guns instead of, you know, ones that had to be moved by hand. And they had burp guns, which are submachine guns, basically, whereas the South Korean army was armed with old-fashioned M1s, not even the latest weapons available. Rifles and
not a single combat plane.
Not a single combat plane. Not a single tank. Very little anti-tank capability. So when the tank-led North Koreans stormed across the border, they just pretty well advanced at will against whatever the South Koreans could throw against them.
And the North Koreans not only knew that they'd be facing a less well-armed group of individuals, they also picked really the perfect date because a large portion of the South Korean army was off on agricultural leave, and a lot of the top brass was really hungover from the night before.
Exactly, yeah. There had been a big party in Seoul the night before, and all the American officers associated with the KMAG, the Korean Military Advisory Group, and the high-ranking South Korean officers were, you know, they partied all night. And they weren't really prepared for what happened, you know, before dawn the next morning.
Which is pretty remarkable given that there were plenty of signs that something like this might be possible. In fact, there were some analysts who thought that it was imminent.
Yeah. Several British diplomats had been predicting for months that there was going to be something like this. A lot of people thought, however, that the real threat to Ri's government came from inside because there was so much discontent and there were so many North Korean sympathizers and saboteurs who were already established in South Korea. So there was a lot of feeling that it could be overthrown from within easier than from without, but that didn't turn out to be the case.
So as far as your research, there was a single American who actually witnessed the start of the invasion.
Yeah, a young American captain who was assigned to this KMAG, and he was the only one who didn't go to the party in Seoul that night. He was back at near the town of Kaesong, which is right on the 38th parallel, and he was awakened about 4 a.m. by the sound of heavy artillery fire, and then a few minutes later, small arms fire very close by, and he was the only American officer to witness the actual invasion.
So talk about the strength of that first. You mentioned that they moved almost at will down from the north. The Americans and the South Koreans were just instantly in a defensive position and retreating all the time.
Absolutely. Seoul fell in just 2 days, and the North Koreans probably could have advanced much faster than they did, but they were consolidating their gains as they went along, and apparently in no great rush. I mean, they were prepared to take a few weeks to completely subjugate South Korea rather than try to do it in a few days. But I think they could have advanced much, much faster than they did.
What led the Soviets to believe that the U.S. would not fight back and the U.N. would not fight back?
Well, there was the feeling that South Korea was not strategically valuable to the United States, and this was reinforced to a great extent by some of the decisions that were made by the U.S. State Department, including Secretary of State Dean Acheson, where they just left the Korean Peninsula out of their strategically important areas that they had designated in the Far East. I think they just thought that the United States would decide it wasn't worth, you know, it wasn't worth spilling American blood to go into a country like this.
Yeah, and the U.S. at this point had literally no appetite whatsoever for a major conflict.
Well, the civilian population certainly didn't, and the generals in Washington had been frustrated largely by the policies of the Truman administration. They were sort of out of sorts about the whole thing, and the soldiers that we had available were not ready to go into combat. They were about as far removed from combat readiness as you could be and still be an American soldier. But there was this arrogance, too, about the Americans. A lot of the rank-and-file soldiers thought that once the North Koreans saw an American military uniform, they'd turn and run. And, of course, they did not.
We'll hear more about that in just a moment from Bill Sloan. He's a former investigative reporter for the Dallas Times-Herald. His newest book is called The Darkest Summer, Busan and Incheon in 1950, The Battles That Saved South Korea and the Marines from Extinction. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
bazooka was some defense, but there were too many tanks and too few bazookas. Day after day, it was pull back and fight again. There were too many of them. You wouldn't know where they'd come from. The rice paddies would lie quiet. We'd hide in the shadows, trying to look like a hut or a cornfield or a rice paddy. Concealment was one of our weapons. There were too many of them. The boys pulled back, tired as dogs. Because whenever they'd meet the Reds head on, the Reds had enough men to fight us on the front and on our flanks, too. We knew it. It was hard to face. We were hurting.
That is a clip from a U.S. government film made after the conclusion of the Korean War. My guest this hour is Bill Sloan. He's a former investigative reporter for the Dallas Times-Herald who now writes about military history. His newest book is called The Darkest Summer, Busan and Incheon in 1950, the battles that saved South Korea and the Marines from extinction. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Bill, we hear there the sort of desperation that these folks were experiencing as they realized they were not only outnumbered, but really outgunned.
Yes, absolutely. The situation deteriorated steadily throughout July and into August. And the people at Busan and in the city of Busan were on the verge of just total panic because rumors were running wild that the North Koreans were going to be there within hours, and there was basically no escape available to most of the Americans that were there. The people who had small boats were, you know, selling passages on those for exorbitant amounts of money just to get someone out of the actual danger zone if the worst happened. But it was really touch and go, and the Marines, the 1st Provisional Marine Brigade, which was consisted of about 6,500 men, and that included an air group and an artillery outfit, too, they got there on the 2nd of August, 1950, and it was really a nick-of-time arrival because if they had been delayed another week or 10 days, I don't think Busan could have held out.
And on top of all the military challenges, there was the problem of making sure that refugees were able to have passage without being caught in the crossfire, which sort of got in the way of the Americans' ability to fight back.
Yeah. Well, Busan itself was swelled to about 20 times its normal population by all the refugees and, just they had poured in from all over South Korea because it was the only city of any consequence that was still in friendly hands. And, of course, the South Korean government had to move there, and it was an absolute melee of, shanty towns and thrown-together military installations and with panic just hovering right beneath the surface.
So starting from the very beginning, General Douglas MacArthur was formulating a plan that would ultimately come to fruition in the counterattack at Incheon, and that plan very much required the services of U.S. Marines.
Yeah. Well, of course, General MacArthur had worked closely with the Marines all during World War II because he was the man in charge in the Pacific, and that was where all the Marine combat units were sent. There were no fighting Marine outfits in the European theater. And one of the first things that MacArthur did after the North Koreans invaded was to ask for help from the Marine Corps. But unfortunately, the Marines were not in a position to supply that help immediately. They did do a pretty good job because they got the brigade put together by before the middle of July and on its way, but still, it took 15 days or more for them to get across the Pacific and get to where they could, jump into the action.
And even a lot of their best weapons had been handed over to the Army.
Yeah, right. The Marines had been fortunate, though, in that they had stockpiled some right after World War II when all this equipment, these trucks and jeeps and guns and everything were in. They were just overflowing with them, and they didn't know what to do with them. and a lot of them were being sold off to civilians and junked or whatever. The Marines got a hold of a bunch of that equipment and put it in storage in the California desert, not far from Camp Pendleton, which was their, you know, main base on the West Coast. And so they were able to get hold of equipment that that the Army had thought they would never need anymore. So they came into the fighting with well equipped with 75-millimeter recoilless rifles and 3.5-inch bazookas to stop those Russian tanks. And by the time they got there, the Army had received a few of those anti-tank weapons, but they didn't have nearly enough. But the Marines, when they came up against the Soviet tanks, they always came out ahead. One guy told me that he said, "We turned those T-34s into caviar cans."
Incidentally, Bill, what was the thinking behind the intention to fully unify the U.S. Armed Services after the end of the Second World War?
I think it was mainly to save taxpayer money. But there was just a feeling among the leaders in the Truman administration, and I think Truman himself, that the military had taken too much control of its own destiny, and it needed to be scaled down, and the duplication was what was really costing the taxpayers unnecessary millions and billions of dollars. And you can see the logic in that. Because you had the Air Force, and then you had the Navy Air Force, and then you had the Marine Air Force. So there was some logic in it, but I think they went way too far, and they weakened the whole military structure of the nation in doing that.
So let's talk about MacArthur's plan, which essentially, instead of focusing on the front where they were barely holding out, put U.S. and South Korean troops far beyond the lines into territory controlled by North Korea.
The plan.
If I didn't summarize it correctly, feel free to.
The plan for Incheon was to simply get a large force far behind the front lines and, surprise the enemy and cut the bulk of the North Korean army off from its base of supply and annihilate it. And that's really what happened with Incheon. It was the Incheon invasion on September 15th, 1950, was supposed to coincide with a breakout offensive by the 8th Army down in the Pusan area. And although the 8th Army offensive was delayed for a few days, it did work out that way. And they more or less caught the North Koreans in a pincher movement and basically killed most of the North Korean soldiers.
And there were heavy troop losses on both sides in those early days.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. The South Korean army was just decimated. They lost almost all of their seasoned officers, of which they didn't have a surplus to begin with. And I don't know, they were so disorganized and in such disarray that it's hard to know how many effectives that were actually in combat for the ROK Army. But I've heard that it was, from expert sources, that it was as few as 25,000 out of an army that had numbered around 130,000 at the beginning of the war.
Can you talk for a minute about the advanced guerrilla team that went to Incheon ahead of the invasion there?
It wasn't really a team. It was one individual.
One guy.
One young Navy lieutenant who had the expertise that they thought they needed to get some information on the tides and the depths of the channel that they had to pass through to get to the invasion beaches.
Because Incheon was not an easy place to reach.
No, it was terrible. I don't see why anybody would ever have built a major port there. But it was, the harbor was surrounded by mud flats, and it was only accessible during a very brief period at high tide and a low tide. And part of the invasion force had to land and sit there because there wasn't time to land the whole group, and they had to just more or less sit there and bide their time until that afternoon when the tide went out again, so that they could get in or came in again, so that the mudflats were navigable. And there's also a very narrow channel that passed through this area, and this young Navy lieutenant really was an unsung hero of the. He later had a book published about the secrets of Inchon is the name of it, and but I'm not sure they could have done it without him.
Yeah, and had they been detected ahead of time, they would have been like sitting ducks because they couldn't go anywhere.
Yeah, right. But you see, the the North Koreans had sent almost all of their combat units down to Pusan to try to, you know, obliterate the Pusan perimeter, and they couldn't get back in time to effectively counter the American invasion at Incheon. If they had kept a large percentage of their fighting force up around Seoul, then it would have been a different story. But there was very few combat troops up in that area, and by the time they got them back up there, Incheon was solidly in American hands.
Bill Sloan is my guest. His new book is called The Darkest Summer, Pusan and Incheon in 1950, The Battles That Saved South Korea and the Marines from Extinction. Join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak to Bert in Dallas. Hello, Bert.
Hello. I'm kind of jumping ahead of your story here because what always amazes me about the war is the bitter cold and what a price the American troops paid, and you know, 50% of the casualties are better are really from the cold as much as anything else. But what always struck me is how in the world did the Chinese fare when they came through, you know, traveling at night and wearing canvas shoes to infiltrate into and around the American positions. And I mean, I know they must have paid a terrible price, but I'm curious, so what do we know about what that price was on the Chinese Army?
Thanks for your call.
Well, we have no real firm idea of how many Chinese were killed during that winter campaign in North Korea. We don't even know for sure how many Chinese poured into North Korea from across the Yalu River. We know that they had been taking up position there long before they staged their first major attacks. They had been slipping across the river and hiding in what they called killing zones, which became exactly that when they did attack. I've encountered estimates as high as 800,000 Chinese troops that jumped into North Korea. It may not have been nearly that many. I've heard other estimates of around 300,000. And I think it was at least that many. They suffered from the cold, just as the Americans did, but somehow it's when you're on the attack, you don't get as cold as you do when you're under attack. And that was, I think, one of the big differences, that plus the fact that they just overwhelmed the American forces with sheer numbers.
Give us some perspective, Bill, on why there was a winter campaign. You've just described this remarkable turnabout in events that would have seemed the perfect place for the Americans and the South Koreans to take victory once and for all, but in fact it stretched on for more than 2 years after that.
Right. Well, I think the blame, if you can call it that, for moving so deeply into North Korea in the middle of winter lies strictly on General MacArthur. Because I don't think it would have happened if he hadn't been pushing for exactly that. I think that MacArthur, the Korean War, the period that he was involved in it, of course he got fired in April of 1951, it represents the very best and the very worst of Douglas MacArthur. He was... The Incheon plan was brilliant. It wasn't all necessary original. Military commanders had done similar things over thousands of years, but it was a good plan, and it did work. And he became thought of in Washington as infallible because of it. And he was in a position to do pretty much what he wanted to do. He met with President Truman at Wake Island in October of 1950, and Truman failed to set any limits on where MacArthur should stop. If they had stopped at the end of October, the Americans would have occupied all of the valuable land area of North Korea. The rest of it was just a frozen wilderness, and there was no reason to continue to advance deeper and deeper into it and further from your base of supply. But MacArthur did. I think personally, and there's a lot of evidence to support this, I think that he wanted an all-out war with Red China, and he was using this as an instrument to trigger that war.
And although President Truman hadn't set limits on MacArthur, this was not his vision whatsoever for the conflict.
No, but Truman's fault was in not setting limits and making it clear to MacArthur what his limits were and what his responsibilities were. But again, I mean, Truman wasn't really a military man. He'd never been higher than a captain in the artillery in World War I, so he was not a great tactician. I just think that nobody could stop MacArthur. He wanted to go on, and he did go on. And that was the kiss of death as far as that North Korean winter campaign was concerned.
Bill Sloan is my guest. He's a former investigative reporter for the Dallas Times-Herald who now writes military histories. His latest book is called The Darkest Summer, Pusan and Incheon in 1950, The Battles That Saved South Korea and the Marines from Extinction. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Yes, our outfits were winning. They were holding back the enemy until help could arrive. We didn't feel it yet, but reinforcements were on the way. It takes time to pour a defense program into a small country with almost nothing. Not all the stuff can get there overnight, even in an age when we're used to things traveling 400 or 500 miles an hour. Oh, we needed tanks and jeeps soon. If some of the boys at the front could have heard the winches grind at the port, that would have been sweet music. And if something... television, maybe, could have shown us the soldiers who were going to fight with us soon, maybe it would have been easier. As it was, the outfits in the foxholes needed every half-track and howitzer and tank they could get, and more, and the men to go with them.
More from that U.S. government film created after the end of the Korean War. My guest this hour is Bill Sloan, former investigative reporter for the Dallas Times-Herald. His new book is called The Darkest Summer, Pusan and Incheon in 1950, The Battles That Saved South Korea and the Marines from Extinction. Bill will be appearing at the Borders store at Preston and Royal in Dallas on November 19th at 7 o'clock. You can pick up a copy of the book there, get it signed, and meet Bill and talk to him about his work. If you'd like to join our conversation this afternoon, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So essentially, Truman fired MacArthur for insubordination.
Yes. He fired him, though. The thing that triggered his firing was that he was issuing communiques that represented his thinking about how the war should be handled, and
while diplomacy was taking place,
yeah, and wrecking U.S. diplomacy or diplomatic efforts to get the North Koreans and the Chinese to the negotiating table at the same time. And he just simply usurped the power of the federal government to do this. And that's what triggered his firing. But Truman had been ready to sack him for several months.
On the other hand, on the home front, Douglas MacArthur was still viewed as very much a hero. People were furious at Truman.
Oh, yeah. They were. I mean, there was a terrible backlash against the Truman administration. And the Republicans in Congress talked seriously about nominating MacArthur for vice president in 1952. They didn't do that, but they did invite him to the GOP National Convention to give one of the nominating speeches. And there was just all over the country, people were angry at Truman personally for doing this to this vaunted valorous hero who had done so much for the United States. There's an interesting little sidelight on a local level. At this juncture, there was a small town near Mesquite, which is out east of Dallas here, called Truman. And when Truman fired MacArthur, the city council went into emergency session and abolished the city of Truman.
Lest anyone think that it was honoring the president.
Right, exactly.
Another North Texas connection. A lot of people know the name Walton Walker because of the roadway. But right. Can you talk about his role? I guess it was mostly early in the conflict.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, Walton Walker was killed in a Jeep accident a couple of days before Christmas, 1950. But he was a real interesting character, a very fiery commander. He only stood 5 feet 5 inches tall, but he drove around madly in this Jeep, which is it had what he called grab bars on it, and he was always clinging to those bars while his driver was weaving in and out of traffic. And in fact, he was killed in that Jeep. He was a great admirer of General George S. Patton, who was also fatally injured in an unfortunate accident. But Walker was really disgusted with the state of his army, his Eighth Army. And he would get in his helicopter and fly over the battlefield and yell at the men below, you know, "You yellow SOBs, stop running and turn around and fight." It didn't do much good, but...
Was it a major psychological blow to the Army when he was killed?
Well, I think it was, but I think it happened at a time when they had been so beaten down psychologically that it was just another nail in the coffin, so to speak. And his replacement, Matthew Ridgway, was a really, really excellent commander. So I'm not saying that he did a better job than Walker, because Walker faced much more difficult circumstances than Ridgway did. But he was a good, solid battlefield general.
How did the course of the war change, Bill, after MacArthur was finally gone?
Well, it settled into a stalemate, mostly. There was very little movement of the lines. It was very reminiscent of the trench warfare in France in World War I. There were little breakthroughs here and there by one side or the other. The lines were pretty stable, and the U.S. forces, the U.N. forces, had reclaimed almost all of the territory that they had lost in the winter of 1950, winter and early spring of 1950. But it was still very, very bloody fighting at places like Pork Chop Hill, and there were tens of thousands of casualties that never needed to really occur, because the war could have ended with a solid victory if MacArthur had just stopped where he needed to stop and fortified a line across the peninsula there. The U.S. had already captured Pyongyang, which is the North Korean capital city, and all the other cities of any consequence in North Korea by the end of October.
The war was technically always a police action from U.S. From the U.S. perspective. Why did President Truman never go to Congress for a declaration of war?
Well, I think he wanted to act as fast and you know, send the forces in as quickly as he could. I think that was one factor. And he also wanted to use the mantle of the United Nations rather than making it seem that it was just an American war. I think his police action terminology was an affront to a lot of the fighting men. I don't think they appreciated it at all. Because it was a war, a real war, and one of the most brutal and horrifying wars in history.
Decades later, of course, Truman's reputation is much better than it was at the moment that he left office. Can you talk about the kinds of things that historians have looked at and said this was the right call?
Well, I think that Truman was a very courageous president. I think it took a lot of courage, especially since he should have known what terrible state his military had sunk to send ground forces into Korea. But Truman also made the very, very difficult decision to drop the atomic bombs on Japan. And, you know, he had a plaque on his desk in the Oval Office that said the buck stops here. And I really believe it did with Truman. I mean, I think he had the guts to do what a lot of other presidents might not have had the intestinal fortitude to do. And I think that that was eventually what aroused the admiration for him in the American public.
There is still officially no peace between North Korea and South Korea.
Right.
Do you think that there is a possibility for that peace in after perhaps Kim Jong-il is completely gone from the scene?
Well, I don't think anything's impossible, but as long as Kim Jong-il is around, it's like dealing with a maniacal four-year-old. I mean, the only thing he wants to do is threaten and rattle his atomic weapons sabers, and I don't think there's any way to negotiate with the man. I think he's very foolish, because South Korea has become a very, very prosperous, progressive country, and North Korea is still stuck in, you know, a time warp. They have never made it into the 21st century economically or socially or any other way.
Why do you think that Americans, looking back on the past century of war, tend to overlook this huge loss of lives and resources in the early 50s?
Well, I think mostly because there was no clear-cut victory there. And Americans don't like to think that they lost a war. I don't think that America lost the Korean War, because we accomplished what we set out to do. We saved South Korea. We turned it into a very prosperous, progressive society, a democratic society, and one of the strongest allies that we have in Asia. But the public just, you know, it's like football fans, you know, a tie is like kissing your sister, and that's basically what it was. It was a tie, but we achieved the goal that we set out to achieve, and that was, you know, saving South Korea from a communist takeover. Other than that, I think it's just because so much time has passed and younger Americans today really don't know anything about the Korean War. They don't know anything about the particulars or the suffering that went on over there. They just, it kind of slipped into the background, and it's never been, there's no museums in this country that that commemorate the Korean War. And history is not not taught in the public education system as much as it was, you know, 40 or 50 years ago. It's just a combination of factors that have sort of let it slip into oblivion.
And the veterans that you talk to, almost to a man, seem to agree with you that the war was successful in terms of its primary goals.
Right.
What tells you that that's more than simply them needing to sort of make sense of their experiences over there?
Well, I have to go back and say, you know, repeat what I've already said, that we accomplished what our main purpose in entering the war was, and that was to save South Korea.
We could have lost it to communism.
We could have lost it totally to communism, and it would have changed the whole power situation in the Far East. We also taught the Chinese that we would fight, and we have never been confronted directly by Chinese forces since then. And I think Taiwan would have been overrun very shortly by the Chinese if we had lost the Korean War. That being said, it's still not a clear-cut victory. But it's not a defeat in the same sense that the Vietnam War was a defeat, because we were driven out of South Vietnam. We have no way of rationalizing what happened there other than to say, you know, we got our butts kicked. And so I don't think Vietnam is forgotten the way Korea is, but it's probably simply because it happened much later in time.
Do you happen to know how the Korean War is approached in our military universities in this country?
I really don't know. I mean, I think that it is studied. I have found a lot of military, Army War College type documents that you know study the strategies in Korea. I don't think it's necessarily emphasized a lot, but I do think that I think our military learned a lot from the lessons that it learned in that darkest summer in Korea. Because we haven't let our armed forces fall into that state of disarray that existed in June 1950.
And we didn't combine them.
Right. We didn't combine them. And thank heavens the Marine Corps is still, you know, as strong a fighting force as it was then. And it's proved very valuable to us in places like Afghanistan and Iraq.
Do you think the Marines might have been eliminated if not for the events of the Korean War?
I think there's some chance that some legitimate chance that they might have been. Even General Eisenhower wanted to reduce them to the level of a ceremonial unit. Of course, he had never worked with the Marines, really, during World War II. He was always in Europe. They were always in the Far East. So that's the way it looked.
Bill Sloan's new book is called The Darkest Summer, Pusan and Incheon in 1950, The Battles That Saved South Korea and the Marines from Extinction. He's got a signing event next week, November 19th at 7 at the Border Store on Preston and Royal. Bill, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming in.
Well, thank you for having me, Chris. I really appreciate it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.